The Tom Woods Show, episode 1251.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey everybody, don't forget my friend Bob Murphy has an amazing new book where he takes all his critiques of Paul Krugman from over the years, all these devastating smashes, and organizes them in one volume according to topic. And these are topics you want to master, and Bob will help make you the master of the universe. Check it out at ContraKrugmanBook.com, and I am the narrator of the audiobook version, and you can get that for free when you check out the Audible offer at TomWoodsAudio.com. Hi, everybody. Tom Woods here. Michael Humer joins us once again today. It's been rather a while since we've spoken to him, but I've talked to him a couple of times about his book, The Problem of Political Authority, which is a book I love. It's one of the books I recommend when people are just getting interested in this sort of stuff, and particularly as they're beginning to radicalize and they want a full-blown, consistent, anarcho-capitalist perspective. That book just packs a punch, even though the title has a, it's a title that, let's say, sounds okay at philosophical conferences. Then you crack it open and you realize this thing is on fire. It's an astonishing book, wonderful book. But today I want to talk to him about an even earlier book that he wrote, and that is Ethical Intuitionism. And in that book, Humer makes a defense of ethical intuitionism where there are objective moral truths. We know them through an immediate intellectual awareness or intuition, and knowing them gives us reasons to act independent of our desires. So these are interesting claims, and I want to explore them with him. But of course, for the full picture, you're going to want to read the whole book. And as always, the books I discuss are linked on the show notes pages, and today's is tomwoods.com/1251. Mike, welcome back to the show.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Ethical intuitionism, when I first saw that title years ago when I interviewed you for The Problem of Political Authority, I thought, well, he is a philosopher and he writes technical works. I'll probably never get to this one. Yeah. Boy, was I, not only was I mistaken, but what a sad little mistake that was, because what a gem this is from 2005. And then I found out you've actually been interviewed a number of times on it. I think in at least a couple cases by libertarians who are interested in the topic. Mm-hmm. So I'd like you to take just a minute to explain in brief the basics of what it is you're claiming in this book. What is the fundamental premise?
Well, so there are a couple of issues. A major issue in metaethics is objective values. Are there any? And so the intuitionist view is yes. What that means is there are facts about what's right and wrong or good and bad that are independent of observers' attitudes. So it's wrong to torture babies, and that's wrong even if you like it or even if you think that it's good or regardless of how you feel about it, also regardless of how society feels about it or whatever. So if society adopts conventions according to which we torture babies, then society will just be wrong. Another part of ethical intuitionism is about our knowledge of ethical truths, which is where the idea gets its name. It's that our knowledge of ethical truths ultimately derives from something called ethical intuition, which is a sort of direct intellectual insight, i.e. you think about an ethical question and it will just seem to you a certain way. And it's on the basis of that that you have a justified belief in the absence of any grounds for doubt. That's a short version of the theory.
Okay. How do you situate, before we get into the details and the arguments, how do you situate ethical intuitionism in the history of philosophy, in the history of moral philosophy as people have grappled with this kind of thing? Where do you lie?
Well, so under the name ethical intuitionism, the theory became popular in the 20th century, early 20th century, especially in Britain. But there's something like this idea going back to Plato, right? Which I take to illustrate that it's a very natural idea, that for as long as there have been people, there's been this phenomenon that you think about something and it just seems right or it seems wrong. And the most natural approach is just, well, let's assume that it is what it seems unless we have a positive reason for doubting that. Right? So, I mean, Plato is not typically called an intuitionist, but he definitely believes in objective values. And he definitely thinks that you have a kind of intellectual insight as a result of contemplating the good and things like that.
Well, how do you use ethical intuitionism as a way of refuting a nihilist, for example?
Well, so the main thing that I say is, suppose somebody has this argument that there are no values, right? Nothing is good or bad, nothing is right or wrong. They must have some reason for believing that. So you could look at the premises of their argument, and then you should ask yourself if those premises are more or less plausible than the premise that, for example, it's wrong to torture babies for the fun of it. Unless they have some starting assumption that's more obvious to you than the wrongness of torturing babies for fun, their argument can't succeed, right? Because it couldn't be rational for you to reject something that's more obvious based on something that's less obvious. For almost everyone, there are some ethical truths that are more obvious than the philosophical premises that are used to support nihilism, right? So philosophers will give premises like, a belief about an objective fact could never be motivating, and moral beliefs are motivating. Therefore, moral beliefs are not beliefs about objective facts, right? But is it as obvious that both of those two premises are true as that you shouldn't torture babies for fun? Right? So like almost like any normal person would find it's more obvious that you shouldn't torture babies.
Well, I already know the answer to this, but let's just raise it. People will say, but you do get the occasional lunatic who does torture babies for fun. Does that refute what you're saying or not?
No. So it's also true that, you know, you get the occasional lunatic who says almost anything that you could think of, right? So, you know, there are people who think that the earth is flat and, you know, in spite of the scientific evidence. And so like the existence of some person who doesn't have the same, who's like, is not aware of the facts, or possibly doesn't even have the same cognitive faculties as you do, doesn't invalidate your knowledge, right? For any cognitive faculty that people have, there can also be defects in it. There can also be people who don't perceive what normal people perceive, right? So you might be thinking about psychopaths, for example, who appear to be incapable of moral reasoning, right? But, you know, sort of like taking that to refute the reality of morality is sort of like taking paranoid schizophrenia to refute our view of the world, right? As you know, the fact that somebody's perceptions or understanding is just going haywire, you know, taking that to show that you don't know anything is kind of crazy.
All right, let me ask you this. Does ethical intuitionism commit us to the idea that disinterested individuals, that is to say people who have no particular axe to grind one way or another, should reach roughly equivalent ethical judgments?
Let's see. I think that's sort of expectable normally in general, but there are many things that can cause people's judgments to go wrong. So people can make mistakes. I mean, you said disinterested individuals, which is meant to control for personal biases, but personal bias isn't the only cause of mistakes. People just make mistakes in everything that they do. Okay. However, I think what we should expect is sort of overall in the long run, people are going to converge because that's what happens in every other area of human intellectual endeavor. People start out with ideas that are badly wrong, but they improve over time.
Okay, because I was wondering how we would square this with, for example, the very possibility of the debate that you just had with Dan D'Amico in Reason magazine about vegetarianism. Now, that's a very important moral question. How ought non-human animals be treated? Yeah. And for us to be arguing something so fundamental. I mean, I was thinking just as a novice, you know, I'm just a regular guy when it comes to philosophy. I was thinking that ethical intuitionism kind of committed us to the idea that when it comes to the major issues, virtually everybody is going to reach consensus on, you know, you don't murder somebody. You may have an argument about what constitutes murder, but we recognize that we don't murder somebody. But then when I got to the vegetarianism question, that is a major moral question, and you two diverge completely. I was just curious about how this fits in with what you're describing.
Yeah, so I do have a forthcoming book called Dialogues on Ethical Vegetarianism. And among other things, I try to understand why there's an ongoing disagreement. To me, it's puzzling because I don't think this is a difficult issue. I don't think it's difficult at all. I think it's about as hard as the question of whether you should torture babies. But I think a number of things are going wrong, and one of them is self-interest. It's just not in people's interest to believe that factory farming is wrong, or that it's wrong for them to buy the products. And, you know, so people just don't want to change their beliefs because then they'd have to change their behavior in ways that would be uncomfortable to them. Another thing that's going on is sort of social pressure. There's just a very strong influence of the status quo. It is the way that things are done in your society currently and have been done for a while just has a really strong influence on people's moral judgments and makes them tend to judge whatever that is to be okay. I think there are, you know, there are probably a number of other factors, but those are probably the two largest factors.
In chapter 5 of your book, you have a section where you respond to some either criticisms or misconceptions of the idea. But I want to throw at you what would be just a baseline fundamental misconception, which would be that you're saying that, look, well, let me put it this way. Some people might say, I have an intuition, you have an intuition, there's no bar by which to judge them, so how does this help us? So can you maybe flesh out the exact process by which intuitionism leads us to moral truths?
Well, so the starting point is we should assume that things are the way they appear unless we have reason for thinking otherwise. You could have reasons for thinking that things aren't the way they appear. And one of those reasons could be that different people have different appearances that conflict with each other. But this is also why we have our practice of moral philosophy. And so if you just sort of like go to the ethics literature, and you can read articles that debate the controversial questions, and they're basically doing what you should be doing if you're an intuitionist. And by the way, most of the people, most of the ethicists do not call themselves intuitionists. But nevertheless, they're doing exactly what you would do if you were an intuitionist. And what's that? Well, so they try to start with intuitions that seem most plausible and are widely shared, and then just sort of engage in a process of reasoning, right? So the fact that there's a conflict between two people's intuitions doesn't mean that, oh, it's the end of the story, and now we have to throw our hands up, you know, and give up. What it means is, well, we can try to reason further. We can think about what factors might be causing our intuitions to be less reliable. We can think about how the question relates to other questions that we might be able to agree more on. We can sort of come up with thought experiments, which bring out further intuitions that could bear on the question. And that's all what goes on in moral philosophy, which is what should be going on.
But if reason turns out to be the ultimate arbiter, then what is the role of intuitionism in the first place?
Well, so I think this question is sort of presupposing that there's this opposition between reason and intuition, which I think is just a deep confusion. So what's meant by reason? It might mean sort of the faculty of making inferences, but there's not really this clear separation between the cognitive faculty by which you infer one thing from another and the cognitive faculty by which you judge what's a plausible premise to begin with. Those things are not really like obviously distinct. There's not an obvious difference between, for example, judging that A entails B, which I guess would be reasoning, and just having the intuition that if A, then B. I guess I should say the first thing is inferring B from A and judging if A, then B. Those aren't really that different. And how do we judge if a premise supports a conclusion? So that is traditionally an intuition. So there isn't really this clear dividing line, okay? Saying that we start from our intuitions is just saying, if something seems obviously correct, let's start with that unless we have a reason to think otherwise.
Right.
And that's not in opposition to saying that, oh, if there's a good argument for something, then that's a reason for believing it.
Let me raise, actually, word for word, one of the objections that you raised to yourself in this chapter, chapter 5. You say, the problem with intuitions, this is what an opponent might say, is that we can never check whether an ethical intuition is correct without relying on intuition. In contrast, empirical beliefs can often be checked by other means. If I doubt whether the table I see is real, I can test this by trying to touch it, by asking other people if they also see it, or trying to put a glass on it. Now, how do you respond to that?
Right, yeah. Well, so whether you can check something or not sort of depends upon what we're counting as the allowed ways of checking. So if the question is, can we check observation? You can only check observation by using other observations. And Similarly, if the question is, can you check intuition? You can only check intuitions by using other intuitions. So like if the skeptic is saying, oh, we have to be able to verify the reliability of an intuition without using any other intuitions at all, that's probably impossible. But similarly, and you know, the same skeptic might say, oh, you have to be able to check observations without using any other observations at all, which is also impossible. Also, by the way, it's impossible to check on your memory without using memory. It's impossible to check on reasoning without using reasoning. But it is possible to check on one observation using other observations. And it is also possible to check on one intuition while using other intuitions. That is, you can see if the intuitive judgments that you have about different cases fit together.
Folks, just a quick message before we go on. You know how little patience I have for people who say, this is the worst economy we've ever had. It's so hard to function in 2018. But at the same time, you have so many opportunities. You can improve yourself. You can learn a new skill. Heck, you can learn enough to start a new business just with a few clicks of a mouse. And I'm talking, of course, about Skillshare, where one membership gets you unlimited access to over 23,000 classes. And we're talking an amazing array of courses. So from animation to accounting to film production, finance, fine art, marketing, writing, music production, and much, much more. Join the millions of students already on Skillshare today with a special offer just for my listeners. Get 2 months of Skillshare for just 99 cents. That's right. Skillshare is offering Tom Woods Show listeners 2 months of unlimited access to over 23,000 classes for just 99 cents. To sign up, go to Skillshare.com/Woods. Again, go to Skillshare.com/Woods to start your 2 months now. That's Skillshare.com/Woods. I'm thinking about the different areas of philosophy. There's philosophy of mind. They're all different areas. You can be an expert in philosophy. And within, for example, philosophy of mind, you can find a number of different perspectives defended by various philosophers. In the realm of moral philosophy, where does ethical intuitionism stand? Is it viewed as an outlier? Is it becoming more mainstream? And regardless of what your answer is, what would be the competing views that really have a lot of intellectual heft behind them?
Yeah, so first, we should distinguish between ethical theory and meta-ethics. So most of what people would think of as ethics would be ethical theory, that is trying to figure out what's right and wrong. And meta-ethics is more about sort of what it means to say something's right and wrong and how we know that something's right or wrong and whether it's objective or not. So intuitionism doesn't tell you actually what's right and wrong. It answers these meta-ethical questions like, whatever we say is right and wrong, is that objective? And how do we know about it and so on, okay? So the competing theories would be, for example, nihilism, nothing is right or wrong. Or subjectivism, what's right and wrong depends upon observers' attitudes, maybe on what people approve of or disapprove of. There's a non-cognitivist theory, according to which statements about right and wrong are not actually asserting propositions. They're not actually trying to describe anything. They're just trying to express somebody's feelings or issue commands or something like that. Oh, and there's another theory according to which ethical truths reduce to descriptive facts. So you try to explain what good is in some other terms without using good. How ethical intuitionism fares in the sort of contemporary debate? It was popular in the early 20th century among British moral philosophers, and then it dramatically lost favor by the middle of the 20th century, mostly due to logical positivism and the ascendance of empiricism. And appears to be making something of a comeback in the early 21st century. I'm not sure how many philosophers are intuitionists. It's clearly a minority. There are about 5 different major meta-ethical theories, of which none of them has a majority, no consensus among moral philosophers. So the biggest issue under debate is whether there are objective values. And at least in the middle of the 20th century, it was pretty clear that most people thought there were not objective values. But by now, it appears that most philosophers think that there are objective values.
That just seems hard to imagine. That would you really be able to corner those people and say, you're really saying to me that it's indeterminate whether murder is wrong? Is that really the position they were taking?
Yeah, so it depends upon who you talk to, right? Some of them would say, no, 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 it's wrong. It's definitely wrong because society disapproves of it, or something like that. Or it's wrong, and when I say that, what I mean is, it makes me feel icky. I don't like it. Now, there's a kind of small minority position where you say, no, 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 it's not wrong because nothing is wrong, right? Because these moral predicates refer to non-existent properties. But most of the people who deny objective values wouldn't say that, you know, probably because it sounds crazy.
Well, just again, I'm sorry for being such a novice, but how exactly does makes me feel icky, which I'm familiar with that school of thought, how is that different from I have an intuition that tells me this is wrong?
Yeah, so, well, the difference is whether there's a claim to objectivity or knowledge. So, and like whether the ickiness is supposed to be cognitive, right? So the non-cognitivist would say, yeah, I just have like a kind of emotional reaction or something like that, or I just don't want there to be murder. The intuitionist is saying, well, I have a kind of cognitive state that represents it to have a characteristic wrongness, which is independent of me. Right? It's not just that it makes me feel bad. It's that actually nobody should do it regardless of how anyone feels about it. So even if I liked it, you still shouldn't do it.
Now, at this point, I want to ask you to try to, well, not try, because I'm sure you can do it, to connect the two books that we've talked about together on the show, because the book that I've recommended to so many people is The Problem of Political Authority. That's such an extraordinary book. It is amazingly well done.
Thanks.
And it seems pretty clear there's a connection between ethical intuitionism and the kind of approach you take in that book. And I wonder if you could make that connection explicit.
Yeah, so, you know, like, as I say, a major issue in ethical intuitionism is about whether there are objective values. You might think that in The Problem of Political Authority, you might think that I'm assuming that there are objective values, like the wrongness of coercing people for no reason. Now, I would say I'm assuming that if and only if all political positions assume that, right? There's no reason why the view that coercion is prima facie wrong is assuming objective values any more than the view that coercion is permissible. The method that I use in that book is sort of starting with the things that seem intuitively obvious about the way people should treat each other, about interpersonal ethics, and then trying to reason from there to political conclusions. I try to start from kind of widely shared and seemingly obvious intuitions. Now, I must say, though, that it seems to me like that's the approach that you should take, like no matter what your views are in metaethics, unless your view is like there are no ethical truths, in which case you also shouldn't do political philosophy, right? So like if there are no ethical truths, then also there are no political truths. So you know, we could give up on both subjects, right? But if there are ethical truths, then I don't see how you could avoid it being the correct method to start from the things that seem obviously correct to most people, rather than like, what's the alternative? Start from things that seem wrong? Start from things that seem correct only to you, but other people disagree with? Like, I don't know what the sensible alternative would be.
Well, the beauty of your book, The Problem of Political Authority, is precisely that you're making statements that virtually everybody agrees with, and then you're simply extending them a little bit and saying, well, if you believe this, if you believe that if we all go out to dinner, I'm not obligated to pay the bill just because other people vote that I should, then why would that apply in other contexts? It's hard, though, to really grasp that you could be dealing with something on which you have almost universal agreement, and then as soon as you proceed in the argument just one or two more steps, you've lost almost everybody.
Yeah, right.
I mean, how do you reckon with that?
I mean, of course, the reason is that people think that the state is special. That is, they believe in political authority, right? So, you know, all these intuitions that I start with have to do with normal people interacting with other normal individuals. But then they say, yeah, but there's this special agent called the state, and it gets to do things that nobody else can do, right? But, I mean, if you ask me to explain why people believe that, you know, I think the real explanations are more psychological rather than logical. Like their real explanations have to do with this status quo bias that I mentioned earlier, especially the fact that well, this is the way that our society has been running for a long time. The reason our society has been running this way for a long time is that really a long time ago, some people decided to take over for reasons of self-interest. And the people who had power decided that they were just going to extract resources and force other people to do their will. And then that just got really entrenched. And once it was entrenched, then there's just this status quo bias where people have this tendency to judge the way things are done in their society to be acceptable. So like that's the real reason, I think, why there's this belief in authority. That's one among several things I say in the book to explain the belief in authority.
Well, there's also just a lack of imagination that the prejudice in favor of the status quo then ossifies into a lack of the ability to envision alternatives.
Right.
So it's not simply that this is the way it's always been done, so I'm going to assume it's fine. It's I can't even imagine, I can't even conceive of another way that we could arrange society. I mean, the only point of view that I can really respect on this, at least at some level, is, okay, I get what you're saying, and yes, I see that the state is engaged in moral enormities, but you know, it's the devil I know is better than the devil I don't know. And it's hard for me to imagine how society could function without it. So yeah, I guess I'm going to have to deal with some theft and some violence and some moral outrages because I'm afraid of the alternative. I mean, I don't think that's a preposterously absurd position for somebody to take who hasn't really looked into this very much.
Yeah, and I should say, my view in moral philosophy is not an absolutist view. So it's not as some libertarians would say that you can never aggress against anyone no matter what. It's just that you have a pretty strong reason to not commit aggression against other people. But if you have to do it in order to prevent the complete breakdown of all social order, then do it, right? So you know, one of the things people think is, well, if we didn't have the state going around forcing everyone to do its will, actually there would just be total chaos and people would be killing each other in the streets. And if that's true, then you better keep the state. Right? So like, you know, on that point, they're not making a moral mistake. I think they are making a factual mistake because they haven't considered the anarcho-capitalist alternative.
And then you do spend the last chunk of that book trying to spin out a little bit exactly how that might work so that people can, and because I think it's kind of frankly a cop-out for some libertarians to say, well, I can't anticipate how the market will develop. Because, I mean, to some degree, that's true. Obviously, there are plenty of things that it would be hard to imagine in the absence of them because, you know, they occur as the result of hundreds of millions of decisions and all that. I get that. But if you're going to try to persuade somebody that he can be protected and secure in the absence of a monopolist over a certain territory, you're going to have to do a little bit better than, well, it'll probably all sort itself out. And so I do think it's necessary at least to and then sometimes you even get libertarians who say that even if you even so much as try to envision it, you're somehow violating libertarianism because it's, you know, it would occur spontaneously. But what is it that occurs spontaneously? The use of reason by a bunch of individuals. Well, Michael Humer is an individual. He's using his reason in this book to explain to you what it might look like.
Yeah, that's right. So, yeah, the way that the market solves problems involves individuals coming up with solutions to the problem. So, you know, it has to be possible for individuals to come up with solutions. Of course, then there's a market mechanism to test the solutions. So most of the solutions people come up with will not work, right? And then we'll just find out in the marketplace which ones work, right? But I mean, I think there's a fair point that if somebody just tells you, you know, the market usually works, so it'll probably work with this, although nobody can come up with any ways that it would work. You know, it would be reasonable to be skeptical.
Right.
Yeah, so that's why I do think that it's important to say some things about how things are going to work out so there won't be criminals running around killing people all the time. Also, even after I tell you some reasonable ideas about how that would work, you could still be skeptical and you still probably should be skeptical because we don't actually know how anything works unless it's tried. You don't know until you do something how it actually works out. But that's why it's also important to come up with ways of gradually transitioning. So if what we had to do was abolish the state completely, you know, all at once and then move over to anarcho-capitalism, that would be really risky. But we don't have to do that. What we could do is we could have the state outsourcing some of its duties, right? So we could start moving over to private security to patrol different areas instead of the government police and see how that works out. If it works out, just sort of spread that, right? And we could have some cases be referred to private arbitration instead of the government courts. And if that's working out, then we could try expanding that. So, and that's how we could move towards anarcho-capitalism without taking unreasonable risks.
Let me ask you one more thing, and this is more of a personal slash professional question. You know, you have some views that I think some people would consider eccentric. Okay, almost everybody listening to us right now shares views that would be considered eccentric. Yeah. But what is it like, not just within the university, but within the academic discipline of philosophy? Because I tend to think that you're probably actually going to encounter a lot of people who have somewhat eccentric views. Are they okay with you having this particular set of eccentric views because eccentricity is just a common feature of the philosophical enterprise, or are you a pariah, or how does it all work?
Yeah, I mean, to some extent, you get rewarded for having eccentric views. Like, if you can give a rational defense of some extreme position that hardly anyone holds, then you get to be kind of famous for that. So, and you can be rewarded. And sort of like in the academic world, what matters isn't so much how many people agree with you, but how many people are talking about you. You know, I'm periodically asked if there's a bias against libertarianism. I think there's less bias in philosophy than there is in other humanities and social sciences. Philosophers are more just sort of interested in the argument. I wouldn't say there's no bias. I think it might be harder to publish libertarian or conservative work in political philosophy. It's not impossible, though. That is, you know, it happens a lot, but it's probably easier to publish bad work if it corresponds to the biases of the referees. And if you're libertarian or conservative, it actually has to be good.
Well, that is fair enough. And I think sometimes people, as you know, we hear a lot of crazy stories about the universities, but you can take that a little bit too far. There are plenty of cases where if you do good work, you actually do get recognized from time to time in academia. You do get rewarded. It isn't just entirely arbitrary and people doing perfectly good work get ostracized for no good reason. That does happen, but it's not as depressing as that sounds. I mean, really, you do the best work you can and you do get, I mean, it doesn't mean everybody's going to be teaching at Harvard. It doesn't mean that everybody gets the promotions that should be given out, but it's not, and this is somebody who has a lot of people come on the show with dreadful experiences in academia. Nevertheless, I think sometimes that we can take this too far. So anyway, your website is a little bit unusual, the URL. It's owl232.net. Now, I'm going to link to that just in case people don't remember that. This will be at the show notes page where I'm also going to link to the two books we talked about, and that's tomwoods.com/1251, which is the episode number for today. And I appreciate your time. Interesting to hear you have that other book coming out. I love that you have books that, I mean, one thing I could never be in academia was a hyper specialist where I basically wrote the same book over and over again, but just with a slight nuance to it.
Yeah.
You're able to go into areas that just interest you and write a book on it. And that's a wonderful thing about academia.
Yeah.
So I'll be interested to read that when it comes out. I have no doubt that it will challenge me. But thanks for your time today. I appreciate it.
Yes, thank you.
All right, folks, tomorrow Dave Smith joins me to talk about the Brett Kavanaugh situation. If you enjoy and appreciate what I'm doing, then do please consider becoming a supporting listener of the show. You get so many goodies. Transcripts of all the interviews are but the tip of the iceberg. And of course, my online community of like-minded folks. We are the vanguard of the coming revolution, ladies and gentlemen. Be a part of it over at supportinglisteners.com, and I'll see you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.